Now, unless you live in Boston or Somerville, phase three of the Commonwealth's reopening begins today. So what does that mean, both in terms of who can reopen and whether they will? On the line to tell us about is WBUR senior statehouse reporter Steve Brown. Steve, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, what gets the okay starting today?
Yeah, you can go to gyms, fitness centers, movie theaters, museums, cultural and historical sites, along with sightseeing tours. Casinos can all reopen as of today. But as we've seen in phases one and two, there will be sector-specific restrictions. You got to wear a face covering. You got to keep socially distanced. There'll be a couple of steps in this phase, by the way. Activities with low potential for contact, such as batting cages, driving ranges, go-karts, bowling alleys, those can all open now. Step two includes activities with greater potential for contact. Think of things like laser tag, roller skating, trampolines. Those will all get underway later in phase three, but the exact date depends on the health data that comes in.
You know, Steve, I hadn't thought about it until I was listening to you sort of lay all that out just now. It feels like this is a sort of an exercise or physical activity intensive phase. Is that true, or is that just my perception?
I think, you know, a few more of these things, are a little more active now, whereas phase one and two were more sedentary. You know, maybe you could go into your office so long as only, you know, less than 25% of the people could be there, things like that, things where everybody kind of keeps their distance. Obviously, roller skating, we might bump into each other.
Good point. Now, we said at the top that Boston, Somerville, they don't start for another week. Why is that? And why has Somerville joined Boston this time? We've seen delays for Boston before.
Yeah, remember that while the state sets the guidelines, it's up to the local communities to enforce those guidelines. And Boston and Somerville just feel that they need an extra week to work with the businesses in their communities to get it right. So therefore, that's why they're having the week-long delay.
Okay, and let's be clear. Just because businesses can open doesn't necessarily mean they will, right? I mean, we still have seen some businesses that were authorized to open in phase two who have decided not to, either out of an abundance of caution or because the scale at which they'd be allowed to open might not be profitable for them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. One of my favorite restaurants near where I live is still closed. They were open for curbside for a while, then they closed saying we were going to get set for reopening, and they're still getting set, I guess. Ultimately, it's up to the businesses themselves to decide when they want to reopen once they've been given the go-ahead by the state for that sector to open. Some businesses might be taking it a little longer to get everything lined up, or they may not feel comfortable bringing their staff in. It just varies from business to business.
Steve, you cover the statehouse. What are you hearing around the statehouse about the level of comfort or discomfort about the pace at which Massachusetts is reopening, especially given what's going on with surges in other parts of the country?
Sure. I haven't heard anything in the building for a while. Of course, everyone here is really working remotely, so it's not like I can hear grumbling out in the hallway here. There was some criticism before phase one got underway back in May from both sides, saying some were saying that the state is going too slow, and others were saying that the state was going too fast. Governor Baker has acknowledged that he's going to get flack from both sides no matter what. But I must say it has quieted down significantly since the process got underway about 2 months ago.
So, Steve, in a couple of minutes, we're going to have some doctors on who are going to talk to us about more about that subject. And I do want to flag for our listeners real quick. They will also take your coronavirus call. So call in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with what questions you have about the phase three reopening, about safety, about contagion and spread, et cetera. To that point, Steve, the governor says he is a little worried about the state moving backward in our fight against the virus. How is the state going to be monitoring that, and what would cause them to scale back the reopening? They haven't done that at any stage yet.
No. Every day, the Department of Public Health puts out their dashboard of public health indicators, and right at the top, there are about a half dozen metrics listed that are the key data points. Their positive test rate, the number of people who died from COVID-19, the number of patients in the hospital with COVID-19, healthcare system readiness, testing capacity, and contact tracing capacities. Now think of each of those having a green, yellow, or red light. If the lights are green or yellow, the reopening plan moves forward. But if a trend starts to turn negative, say a red light, goes yellow, that's when I would expect that a possible retreat in the reopening procedure.
And Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe we've had any moment in the dashboard yet where it's been all greens, right? We're still at a combination of green and yellow.
And we probably won't get all greens. One of the things is, the death rate. And so long as there is a single death, then that is not going to be green. That's always going to be a yellow light. So until that, that's a long way away. But conversely, since they started doing this, we haven't gone anything back to red. So that's a good sign for now. But as soon as you start seeing that, then they're going to start thinking about maybe we need to tweak this or tweak that. And how they do that remains to be seen. That'll be up to the governor and his administration.
All right. We will keep watching alongside you. That's WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
All right, so as phase three gets underway, we have many more questions, and we know you do too, about what this could mean for the potential spread of COVID-19. We want to have more of that conversation today. So we have another panel of local health experts to help answer our questions and yours. Remember, you can call in at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us to help with the conversation today is Dr. Shira Daron, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Daron.
Great to be back.
And also with us is Professor Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Welcome back to you too, Lenny Marcus.
Well, glad to be with you.
All right, and I'm going to ask you both this question. Maybe Dr. Daron, you can answer first, but I really want to hear from both of you. How are you feeling about the fact that we have started phase three this week? Dr. Daron, maybe you go first.
Well, I am feeling lucky. I'm feeling lucky to be a resident of Massachusetts right now. I feel like our governor and our government have really listened to the experts, have adhered to the plans that were set forth, and have really crushed that curve in every possible way. And so I think I'm excited that we are able to be in phase three.
Professor Marcus, how about you?
Well, I second what Dr. Daron said. And in particular, we can learn a lot about best case and worst case scenarios when we look at what's going on in other states and other countries. And Massachusetts has taken such a different strategy from states like Florida, Texas, Arizona. And we see the results of the policies that were put in place there and the impact that it's had on their dashboards. So yes, feel very fortunate that we live here in Massachusetts and do hope that we all will recognize that we made a huge investment in getting to this point. And there were sacrifices in getting to this point. And I hope that everyone in the Commonwealth will continue what we've been doing so that we'll be able to march forward in reopening our economy.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. To ask your question, we have Jeanette on the line from Northborough. Jeanette, go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, thanks. I don't know who's going to answer this, but my question is, when do Alcoholics Anonymous meetings start taking place in person? Because I know individuals, I've worked in a homeless shelter, and there are people not able to do Zoom AA calls. So I'm wondering when they can reconvene.
Great question. Dr. Daron, what do you know about that?
That is so hard. And there are so many people recovering from drug and alcohol addiction that need those meetings so badly. And you're right, Zoom just doesn't cut it for some types of interactions. But I do not know where that fits into the plan.
And I think it's those meetings are very important. And so think creatively. It's possible, if people are willing to do it, to hold meetings outside. So if people are outside with a mask, with social distance, making a very big circle, everyone brings their own chair, for example, in a park, it's possible, again, thinking very creatively about finding opportunities to hold very important meetings like that, because especially in a case like this, being able to be with other people is a real plus. So if we can find ways to safely be with other people for that scenario, as well as others, it's just a good thing for all of us.
Very true.
You know, hearing Jeanette's question and hearing both of your answers makes me want to ask again about the mental health implications of the level of social distancing, isolation, inability to be with people that you love or the support networks that you care about. And are we as a state, as a commonwealth, as a country, paying sufficient attention to that? And how will we understand what the public health impacts of that will be now and over time?
Well, people who work in mental health have placed a great deal of attention on the impact that it's having on all of us, including mental health professionals. And that's why it's really important for us to keep driving forward, being very, very careful. I think it would be very demoralizing at this point for us to have reached this, you know, to this level, phase three, and then to blow it and then have to go backwards. That would just be very, very difficult, which is why it's really important for us to recognize step by step we're moving forward. And depending on your individual risk profile, and depending on how much risk you're able to take, getting together with people outdoors, it's a wonderful time of year for that. Making sure to wear masks, keep social distancing. Those are all things that we can think about creatively, and they will allow us to address some of that forlornness that I think we're all feeling, having been in this situation for so long.
Dr. Durone, building on that. Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think the combination right now of the good weather and where we are in on the curve, in other words, a 1.8% test positivity rate in Massachusetts, which means that if you do get together with a small group of people, well distanced and outside, the chance that any one of them has asymptomatic COVID disease is low. Both of those things make this time right now the right time to get out and do some careful socializing.
Let's actually grab another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your phase three reopening or coronavirus question. We have Susan on the line from Andover. Susan, what's your question?
Hi, mine is more just of the spread. I have a question about, does the virus live on clothing? Because I read a lot that sometimes the advice will be, when you get home from the grocery store, wash your clothes, you know, take your clothing off right away. And I just wanted to confirm that. It just seems, I don't know, I've been reading conflicting things. I wanted to see what people's advice was about that.
Thanks, Susan. Who would like to answer
sure.
that one?
I'll start. Yeah. Conflicting is right. So, you know, even just the fact that in the hospital, healthcare workers wear gowns to cover their clothes, which sort of suggests that maybe the clothing is going to be a major determinant of spread. And really, we don't think that's the case. The virus doesn't survive all that well on anything for long periods of time, and it really doesn't like textiles at all. I personally do not take off my clothes and wash them right away when I come home. Certainly any washer or detergent that you use is going to easily kill the virus, but I would not worry too much that it will get off your clothing and onto anything else in your house or onto your hands and create and cause disease.
You know, our chance of bumping into yeah. someone who has the disease here in Massachusetts keeps going down as the numbers of cases go down. I was speaking with my niece yesterday in Arizona, and that's a very different scenario where there are so many cases. They're spiraling upwards. So the fact that the chances of our bumping into someone with COVID-19 at this point are lower allows us not to be as careful, concerned, or anxious as we were in the first weeks of this disease.
So this was a something I was kind of thinking about asking you after the last caller and your answer there. But in listening to the two of you again, what is the balancing act between recognizing that and taking the kind of hope or relief from what you're saying and making sure that it doesn't move us into being less vigilant than we should be about wearing masks and face coverings, about being socially distanced, especially as the emotional and social fatigue of that continues to wear on. You know, the Globe reported that according to a poll conducted June 18th through the 21st by Suffolk University, there was about a decline of 25 percentage points from early May in people who say that they are being very strict about social distancing.
Yeah, well, quarantine fatigue is real. And we still have to follow all the rules. And so, you know, what we don't need to worry so much about is, as Dr. Marcus was saying, is the extras that people might have been doing, the wiping down of the grocery bags, you know, the taking off your shoes at the door, you know, some of the stuff that was, you know, questionable in the first place. This is the time to relax on some of those things. But we do have to follow the rules about distancing, the rules about masks when you can't keep your distance, and especially inside, and the hand hygiene. You know, those are the most important things, and we can't stop doing that. And we only need to look at the curves from some of the other states that are not very far away to know what can happen if we stop doing those things.
I agree with what Dr. Durone just said. Yesterday, my wife and I went grocery shopping. We followed exactly the same rules that we did on week one. The main difference was we were just less anxious about it, and that felt a lot better, and we were able to smile through our grocery shopping. So that's thanks to a lot of hard work that we've all accomplished over these last 4 weeks. So therefore, really important that we keep that up.
Let's go to another call, 800-423-8255. We have Dave on the line from Yarmouth. Dave, what's your question?
Well, before we start patting ourselves on the back, remember 8,000 people died in this state from this disease, and over 50,000 have died in the Northeast from this disease. So we have to remember that. But my main question is about the aerosol spray, for lack of a better term, that the argument is going on that a lot of scientists or some scientists want the CDC and WHO to say that it's spread that way. And what you're feeling about that, considering that we've had the disease now for 3 months, and have we seen that type of thing? Because we would have seen a lot more infections, wouldn't we, if it transferred that way?
Thanks for the question, Dave. And just to round that out a little bit more, we know in reporting, for example, in the Boston Globe, that 239 scientists from 32 countries wrote an open letter to the WHO outlining some evidence showing that these smaller particles can infect people. And they're calling for more research in this area. What can the two of you tell us about that?
Yeah, great, great question. And also thank you for the reminder about the devastating numbers that we have seen here in Massachusetts. And while we can be proud of our accomplishments, we did have quite a surge here in the state, and we lost a lot of Massachusetts residents. So in terms of the question of airborne versus droplet transmission of an infection, there's a lot of talk about this over the weekend, and there's really been a lot of talk about this from the very beginning. The issue comes down to the fact that it really isn't a dichotomy. It isn't the case that there are strictly droplet transmission organisms and strictly airborne transmission organisms, and that's why sometimes we get all kind of jumbled up in our discussions about this. It is not a truly airborne disease the way measles and tuberculosis are. And we know that based on the epidemiology. We know that based on the fact that we have not seen, you know, people transmit to others through a building's HVAC system, for example. We know from the Diamond Princess cruise ship attack rate, which was about 19%, that, you know, even people in very, very close quarters for a prolonged period of time did not transmit at a rate that you would expect from an airborne disease. That being said, we also see the type of transmission that can't be explained strictly by large droplets that should only be able to travel for 6 feet. And so there's probably a continuum when it comes to disease transmission, where the virus sometimes doesn't follow the 6 foot rule. And that is probably when you are in close contact with somebody who isn't coughing or sneezing, so droplets aren't being created. So that's a close range aerosol. And it's also probably happening in situations where there's enclosed space, poor ventilation, and for some reason, a lot of virus, like singing or exercising or yelling, or someone or more than one someone who might have a high viral load because of where they are in the disease. So a lot of factors that can come together to create something that looks more like what we think about when we talk about airborne transmission than droplet, but not a truly airborne type of disease transmission in the true sense of the word.
So Professor Marcus, we have about a minute left. I'm leaving a bunch of callers unable to get their calls in, but I do want to ask one question. One caller wanted to know how we should deal with people coming back from vacations from other states, especially states with high infection rates right now.
You know, there's a term that we use in Homeland Security that says, see something, say something. So if we find that somebody's not wearing a mask, coming back from a vacation and not being careful on their return, then we all have a collective responsibility to, you know, see something, say something. And in a very polite and encouraging and understanding way, just make sure that we're all on board with the same program.
All right. And callers, I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of you today. We will do this again, so just keep listening. In the meantime, that was Professor Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Thanks, Professor Marcus.
Thank you.
And Dr. Shira Durone, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. It was good to have you back again, Dr. Durone. Thank you.
Thanks so much.